Hey everybody, and welcome to another week of Women on War podcast. I'm your host, Jillian Drapla.
And I am your host, Alyssa Atkins. But before, wow, and I already messed it up. Man, tagline,
That's
words
okay.
and
That's
stuff.
okay. We're
That's
not
okay.
perfect. We're not
No, we're
perfect.
not. Although this is my second week in a row messing it up.
That's
But
okay.
let's reel it back a little bit and just say we are at your two not so average museum gals who like to talk various topics of warfare, all the while slinging some jokes and drinking. So I'm
Yes.
actually finally drinking this week. Medication's going well. I actually showed Jillian the bottle in which I'm drinking from, and it's a
I feel like
Gatorade
it, but I feel like
bottle
it goes very well with our theme this week, which is cryptology.
it is. Oh man. But I also feel like I'm back to college football Saturday at
Yes.
the University of Michigan. I'm not gonna lie. Yeah, in school. But the funny thing is that yesterday Blake had made me a drink, which is Simple Time Mixers blue or blackberry lemonade, which is so good. And Jameson Caskmates. I could not finish it just because I did take my medication a little bit earlier. I looked on the counter and I was like, oh man, I don't want to pour this down the sink because it's still pretty full. So I looked to the left and noticed an empty Gatorade bottle. So I rinsed it out, poured it in there, put this bad boy in the fridge, and nobody knew until I told them that I was drinking from
There you
it.
go. There you
Cryptology for
go.
you
And I
folks.
have my wonderful like sparkler tumbler cup. I'm not saying what I'm drinking. Y'all are having
So
to figure
fancy.
that out. Yeah,
So fancy.
this was like my discounted like Starbucks, like Teavana Starbucks like cup that I got for like $6.
It's so mesmerizing. I'm gonna do oh shiny things, I'm sure, during this episode every time
Ooh,
you
shiny. It's kind of like Detroit Red Wing
pull
colors too, a little
that
bit.
out.
Okay, we're getting off topic. So
Oh, it is. Oh, yep, sorry.
we that's okay. That's okay. This is what the podcast is all about, just girls getting together, talking history, talking military history. And you know what? We're talking about badass females in history. We have so many cryptologists to discuss, mainly Joan Clark.
My girl.
And I think we should start off with her. But I also texted Alyssa earlier this week and said, I'm at Barnes and Nobles. I'm turning into you. I literally bought like $65 worth of books at Barnes and Noble this week.
Nothing
And
wrong.
nothing wrong with that, especially because they're all like, actually well-researched books. And 3 out of 4 of them are, written by the person, like Shifty Powers, Dick Winters, and I'm starting to get into like the Pacific Theater. It was, nothing ever that really like connected with. But now I'm like, okay, great. But I digress. Anyway, I got this book that's The Woman Who Smashed Codes, and it's all about Elizabeth Fieldman, who her and her husband started the NSA, and J. Edgar Hoover took all of her credit because
Men.
So, but Joan Clark, Alyssa. For those who don't know who Joan Clark is, who is Joan Clark?
Joan Clark was, well, I guess to sum it up in the most simplest way, is that she was the only female who was doing code breaking at Bletchley Park during the Second World War. Most people will know this name, in which she was assisting in, or assisting with, I should say. She was helping Alan Turing decode the Germans' Enigma machine, which was undecodable for a very, very long time, throughout the war. So that's basically a nutshell of her. She was not necessarily a cryptologist, but a cryptanalyst, and she was also a numismatist. So basically numbers, right?
Yes.
Math, everything along those lines. She was truly just be like brilliant beyond all measure. Just to even sum it up, I mean, women during the 40s really weren't known to be mathematicians by any means. However, she, I would like to say, especially in a military type setting, really broke the mold for women in that type of field.
Yeah. And I just want to, like, for our listeners, because, you know, this book that I got, it gives me like a dictionary page of like what all these terms mean, because it's all, you know, cryptology, cryptologists, you know, there are a lot of crypts. So just to let everybody know, a cryptographer is like, think of it like a professional who makes a lock, and a cryptanalysis is the person. Cryptanalysis, code breaker, they were interchangeable terms, but they basically pick the lock that the cryptographer makes. So yes. Just want to like put that out there for people so they don't get confused, and mainly so I don't get confused. It's been a long day at work.
I agree. I know I briefly touched on this, I think last episode, with Anna Smith Strong, because she was in espionage, and Joan Clark was truly the person, like the woman who really motivated me when I was doing or attempting to enlist both times to go into cryptology, because of recognizing patterns and knowing that a female could really do it. I'm sure, you know, there's probably tons of females now that are in cryptology or cryptanalysts, right? Mm-hmm. But I would like to say that a lot of it has to do with computers now. Mm-hmm. She was strictly code breaking the Enigma machine, which literally was not necessarily computer based by any means, but I digress. I mean, Alan Turing did technically, I think, really make the first computer with what he called Christopher. So the fact that Joan Clark was a part of it really was something that opened up my eyes, because, like I said, she was just incredible beyond all measure. To give like a brief background for some people to really like dive into why I consider her to be incredibly brilliant. She attended Dulwich High School for Girls in South London. So at the time, you know, once again, women were not granted mathematics degrees by any means or anything of that sort. She was recognized, I think, actually by a professor at Cambridge. However, though, she wasn't necessarily at Cambridge, right? Because a woman couldn't be at Cambridge. She was at Newnham College, which was a subsidy, I believe, of Cambridge, but strictly just for females. Anyway, Gordon Welshman was her professor for this undergraduate geometry class that she had. And Welshman at the time was one of four mathematicians that was recruited, I think, in 1939 to supervise the decoding operation. So he noticed her talents right away. And at her time, though, at Newnham College, she actually had a double degree. So mathematics and Wrangler was her degrees. And she basically, with going to being noticed at the time, women, like she would have, I guess I'm going to backtrack a little bit. So 1939, right, is also a time where women do not have the capability, I should say, to really branch out. They are known as the girls, aka the clerical women at Bletchley Park. And so the fact that her professor is like, you are a brilliant mathematician. I know you are. You recognize patterns. You can do all these insane things that most women are apparently unheard of to do. I would like you to come to Bletchley. So then she did. Eventually, she arrives, I think, in 1940. And cryptology really was not, once again, considered a job for women, particularly in England. Although there's cryptologists or cryptanalysts, I should say, in Paris, right? At least for some of the, I think, the American side, there was some, not a whole lot. But she really broke the mold, I will say, especially for women who were in England or the United Kingdom, you know, who have citizenship there. So she really becomes the first female there, and she just, holy crap, just blew everybody out of the water. I think I like referencing movies, to be honest, and like shows, because I think it also gives like a good representation for people, but also to point out historical inaccuracies, because I love doing that too. But The Imitation Game, which came out, God, I don't know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, something like that. It's an accurate depiction of when she goes in to take the crossword puzzle that Alan Turing gave everybody, and they all look at her like, the heck, what are you doing here? Like, shouldn't you go do the clerical work and all that other stuff? And she did it within time, and the rest is history. So yeah, she's a badass. Yeah. I love her so and much.
I was reading up on her. So, they decoded Navy ciphers.
Well, Pat.
In like real time.
Mm-hmm.
Too. That.
Yep.
What?
And
they're not using, and the thing is that they're doing it from literally like pen and paper or pencil and paper. There was technology, but not like we have it today for doing that sort of thing. So, and they were just like, all right, cool. Going right off on it. I'm like, what? That, okay. Ooh, I got a lot of work to do on myself, I guess. But seriously,
I was just going to say, I mean, once again, like now we can easily plug, equations, mathematical equations, and, that can decipher patterns or just really, I mean, being a cryptologist or cryptanalyst today, or even a cryptographer, you have all these things at your disposal. Sure, you have to know all these equations, but the computer really eliminates you looking for those specific patterns in a lot of ways. So by using pen and paper, you can actually have more of a visual to it. And she, being a part of the government code and cipher school, right? So that is GC and CS is the abbreviation, I believe, is what the English use.
Mm-hmm.
She was also really trained to do that as well. I mean, math really, like if you look at it from like any type of standpoint, it really is like just trying to figure out patterns.
Right.
If you can figure out patterns, usually you're pretty good with it.
Mm-hmm.
I should say at the higher levels, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the higher level of math, when you no longer use numbers, it's symbols and letters and more symbols and Greek letters.
Seriously.
Sigma, Kappa, Alpha. And you're just like, what the heck is going on?
Yeah.
Alpha, Beta, Charlie. You're like, are we in a sorority? Are we in a fraternity now? Like, what are these symbols? What are we using them for?
Oh, God. What would, like Alpha, Beta, Foxtrot or something like that. Woo.
Go oh, the phonetic go. Alphabet?
Yeah. But it's, like, if it was like a sorority.
But if it was a sorority for cryptography. Like,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I see where you're going with this.
Yeah.
Getting back on topic about Joan Clark though, and how they had to use pen and paper, really trying to decipher the German Navy, but really it was the wolf packs, right? Because that was what they called them. She was basically, even at the same time while they were doing that, she was the only female practitioner on Van Burismus, which is the name that Turing gave for what we call the Turing machine. And it essentially helped reduce the need for bombs, which are electromechanical devices, that were used by Welchman and Turing in the earlier times, that they used basically to decipher those messages. She was also, I guess, what they considered to be a linguist at the time, which I think is really interesting because she did not speak any other language other than English. So for her to be a cryptologist, like cryptanalyst, it's kind of funny because you're like, wait, what? You should know German.
Yeah, I did see somewhere.
Did you see that?
Said, like, grade linguist, languages, none.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
She had to fill that out on paperwork.
But I think a lot of it does have to give credit though to you at the same time, because she more than likely had to learn various phrases, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as they were trying to encode the Enigma machine, because the Enigma machine was very, obviously it's a machine, it's very calculated. And so it's using certain words and certain phrases right. at certain times of the day to basically get its message out. So basically, I'm trying to think of like, by using this and you trying to decode Enigma as well as any other German messages, I think one of the things that I like putting up, because obviously Turing and the men typically get a lot of the credit for these things because it's history.
Yeah.
Male written history. The Wolf Pack specifically sunk, I think, 282,000 tons of shipping basically per month from I think anywhere from February, March to June of 1941. But by November of 1941, Clark and the team reduced it to about, it's like somewhere in the 60,000s, I think, 63,000, I think.
Oh, wow.
So, yes. And so, Hugh Alexander was the head eventually of Hut 8, which Hut 8 is the sector that she worked in.
Okay.
And he, to once again to show how brilliant she was, he described her, and I have to look for the quote, described her as one of the best van Buress in the section, in which Alexander himself was regarded as the best of the van Buress. So he and I.J. Good consider the process more an intellectual game than a job. And so when that comes down to it, you know, I mean, looking, going back to the Imitation Game and looking at how serious and intense Alan Turing was, like, could you imagine working with Alan Turing and being like, you know, you're already, odds were already stacked right away against her, right? Because she's a female in cryptology. But it's the fact that you're also dealing with Alan Turing. So, yeah. But I mean, at the same time, Alan Turing really saw her capabilities and I think truly did look past eventually about her being a female and really just let her take the reins and see what she could do. And that's why Hugh Alexander and I.J. Good, who were her more or less just the people that she worked with, that's why they said those things, that she was truly one of the best van Buress. Because if you actually have seen pictures of the van Buresmus,
I have not.
That thing. Ooh, I'm looking. Okay, briefly.
Okay, listeners. Let me pull it up. Hang on.
So van Buress, it's just basically this entire machine, right? So it's the knobs that they had. It's, if you watch the Imitation Game, like they have this big thing. It's what Turing, like I said, called Christopher. And it's, so they take out the, I guess you can almost call them the plug, and then put it back in. And they keep doing it until they can get every single one of them locked a certain way where they just stop working.
Okay.
Yes. Not stop working, but stop moving.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. This thing.
Yes. And that is the Bombay. So it's so crazy.
That is terrifying.
It is. So eventually, though, one thing that I want to say too, because it is really truly an intellectual, it's an intellectual game trying to decode these messages. Like I said, finding these patterns. And because she was, you know, well versed, well, even if she wasn't technically a linguist, mm-hmm. The fact that her math, she just knew mathematics basically. She does eventually become the deputy head of Hut 8 in 1944. However, she could not progress further than that, and she made less than the men.
I can't. On a scale of one even, I can't.
And this is why I drink.
Cheers to that.
Cheers. Which is so unfortunate because It just makes me so mad because she proved herself to those men and they didn't do anything to really help her. Like when we discussed Annie Etheridge, you know, the men just all across the board were like, you need to do this, you need to do that because she is right. one of us and all this sort. I truly wonder if Joan Clark was not involved, I wonder how far they would have gotten with just the men. And I'm not just saying that because, you know, she's a female and I love her dearly and she truly is like the equivalent of my Leslie Knope in cryptology, if I'm going to be quite honest. Right. but she is, I think just having that different set and the general understanding and, you know, women typically do go with their intuition and they also can think very logically at the same time. But more so, I feel like in a broader sense, men sometimes can be very narrow-minded. They don't look at the bigger picture sometimes. And I mean, I'm not saying all men, I'm just saying a lot of the men I do know.
They don't stop a lot of the men I know. Directions. I don't know. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm kidding, guys. I'm kidding.
But are you? And this is why we drink part two. Just kidding. But to go back to being, you know, to just truly being serious with Joan Clark, and doing that comparison where women can actually look at the bigger picture while also looking at the smaller details, men typically can be very like short. They just want a very clear and concise answer, right? You look at Turing and Turing's like this, 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 and this, and you're like, that's not how it's going to work. Hugh Alexander was very similar. And so you have all these men who very much look at these situations or these numbers or anything like that. Like, okay, well, this is the answer. And Joan Clark, also being female, can look at it, I believe, and I think I actually read something where she would look at it from a different angle and perspective and be like, okay, well, maybe what about this pattern? Or what about this? If I remember correctly, I forgot who specifically it was that realized some parts of the code and like, wait, you know, hail Hitler is the code for this and, you know, and so on and so forth. But I think if I once again remember correctly, I read so much about her that everything is also starting to mesh. So I apologize, listeners. I do believe that she was also one of the ones who was sitting next to them and being like, wait, there's this part of this code. There's this part of that code. And then she starts piecing it together and everybody else comes around her and really pieces it together. Once again, that's how just wonderful, wonderful that woman is.
Yes. You know what it kind of reminds me of real quick, and this is not – she didn't work in cryptology or anything like that, but, I mean, that story kind of resonates so much with me with Katherine Howard Johnson, who worked for NASA. Mm-hmm. She was the female mathematician who worked for NASA and just kind of, you know, proved her way through and saw the bigger picture. And that, like, to me, like, my mind was just, like, connecting the dots there, even though they're two, you know, kind of unrelated stories. One, you know, with more science and the other one with, well, I mean, this is science too and code breaking and everything. I think it's just absolutely incredible that we had these women do it. Now, I do like want to touch base on Elizabeth Fieldman. Going from Joan Clark to traveling across the pond back home to us, Elizabeth Smith Fieldman and her husband essentially started the NSA. They were, what I find is really interesting is like they both love Shakespeare. It turned out from like a little love story. It was really interesting. She actually loved Shakespeare. Didn't know that. And she would travel to like a library to read like old texts of Shakespeare. And she could read them. And the librarian is like, how the hell are you reading like old English right now? Because no one can read what that says.
But when you're brilliant and ingenious, you can do whatever the flying fuck you want.
Exactly. Exactly.
Who runs the world. Girls.
Girls. Girls.
Girls.
Women. Women.
It's okay.
So, yeah, it is kind of interesting that she was reading I had to pull it up. It was a 1623 original edition of the playwright's first folio.
Not gonna lie, I would.
Yeah, that's it. If I could, I would. But like, good for her. So anyway, this librarian was impressed by her doing this. She got her in touch with this eccentric millionaire seeking researchers to work on a Shakespeare code cracking project. I had to like pull this up to get it right because I want to get it right because we owe it to this woman to get it right. So anyway,
Absolutely.
So long story short, she met her husband doing this research project. And after World War I broke out, this millionaire offered the government the assistance of the scholars. And so this couple, they started, you know, breaking down messages. And she was basically ahead of this U.S. Coast Guard unit. And she monitored Prohibition-era smuggling rings, which her and her clerk decoded 12,000 encryptions, which led to 650 criminal prosecutions, and she testified as an expert witness on 33 of them. Fast forward to World War II, the Navy took over the Coast Guard unit and essentially demoted her because women couldn't serve fully in the military during World War II. We have the WACS, the Women's, you know, Auxiliary Corps.
Waves.
Which were WASPs. Don't even give me. There's so many things. But and the Waves, like, they had a, you know, it was women accepted for volunteer emergency service. So it's a long title, but I like how it ties in with the Navy. It's kind of cute. Anyway, so she gets demoted from her role, and she then works back for the Coast Guard and in like a smaller team that just eavesdropped on German spies as they discussed like where their ships were moving in South America. And damn it all to hell, the Germans found out that they were being spied on, which sucked because all of their, you know, spying, right. it was, they couldn't have anything. It was horrible. Where did it say? I had to pull it back up because I wanted to get it right. But, J. Edgar Hoover, he, you know, head of the, you know, FBI director, head of the FBI, he made a career-defining move that tipped the Nazi spies to the U.S. intelligence activities by hastily raiding sources in South America, which is, you know, just why take it slow and just kind of like, oh, maybe like make them think like, oh, no, we're not onto them. No, make them feel safe and then snatch from them slowly. No. We're going to go all gung-ho. We're just going to go right for it. And we're just going to be like, oh, yeah, they for sure were listening. Yep. Why? Because everything we had is now gone. Which, I mean, I guess there's, like, a good way and a bad way to do it. Maybe. I don't know. Anyway, back to Fieldman. She and her team worked on breaking 3 separate Enigma machine codes, which is pretty cool. In 41, and 42, her team cracked every one of the Nazi new codes, which is just incredible. Every single one.
I do have a question though. So with Elizabeth Friedman's Enigma, was it the Army or Luftwaffe Enigma? Because there was 3 separate Enigma machines. There was the Navy or the Naval Enigma, Luftwaffe Enigma. Enigma, which for people who don't know Luftwaffe, it's German, the Nazis' air force, essentially. And then the army loop, or the army Enigma machine. Do you know which one it was? Well, obviously not Naval, because Bletchley Park was Naval.
Yeah, I don't okay. know, but I will find out. I will bring okay. that code and I will find out. Also, every time I hear Luftwaffe, is it bad? I just think of like loofah.
No.
Luftwaffe, no, definitely not. And loofahs. But I digress. I'm not telling you what's in this cup.
That's okay. Remember, gotta break it. Gotta break the code. The reason why I was asking those two is because Army and Luftwaffe Enigma was actually far like harder to break, apparently, according than the Naval Enigma that Bletchley Park or Hut 8 with Turing, Alexander and Joan Clark had to go basically to break. So I was curious because, I mean,
I'm sure I'll find out more like the further I get into this book because, mm-hmm. I mean, that's just the crazy thing about this story is that her story didn't become declassified until 2008.
Ooh, comparison again to Joan Clark, because this is what I love doing at this moment. Not much information is still, like, a lot of the stuff at Bletchley is still considered classified, which I found out as I was reading up a little bit. There was three other cryptologists or cryptanalysis at Bletchley, but they were not up to speed with Clark. They weren't necessarily part of Hut 8, so they weren't necessarily decoding the Enigma machine or Naval Enigma. But I do want to note who those women were because I think it's critically important.
Yes.
Margaret Rock, Mavis Lover, and Ruth Briggs. They were a part of GCCS, but they did do code breaking. So once again, who runs the world? Girls. And take a drink. Whatever you have in front of you, every single time I say, who runs the world? Girls, take a drink now, like I'm going to do, because here we go.
Cheers. Cheers, Red. Well, it's just, I mean, it's crazy to me that in history, you know, history is not balanced. It's very male-dominated. And it's just crazy to me thinking, you know, Joan Clark, you know, so J. Edgar Hoover took all of her credit for everything that she did.
He did.
Her husband is literally, like, they say at the NSA that he is the founder of cryptology, when really it was him and his wife. And actually, if you go to the agency, you can actually, like, look through her private collection. Her diaries mm-hmm. were all in code. Their family wrote letters to each other in code. And they're just like these boxes, like these, you know, museum boxes, just full of her stuff. And the librarian there is so excited to show people that specifically asked to see her things because she is so, you know, underrepresented. And she died in 1980, and her role wasn't like released to the public in World War II until 28 years later.
Which is, I understand the whole classified components, correct? Because there is a standard in the military for things to like remain classified that I like give to them. However, I think it's absolute, and I'm gonna say it, I think it's freaking bullshit that for these badass women to be known, you have to dig and dig and dig. It's like, at this moment, you're like, get me a freaking excavator because I'm just going to dig as much as I can. Get me a bulldozer. And it's just, it's infuriating. And I'm not honestly saying this because, yes, I'm a female historian. Yes, I'm also a female historian who tried enlisting. And these two women were in the field that I wanted to go into. I'm saying this because history is so skewed. Like,
yeah,
it is so unbelievably skewed, and it's infuriating, not just even on like on the basis of sex, on race, on just everything.
Yeah.
Everything. And it's just, God, Why? Just freaking why?
Right.
This is why we have the podcast.
Exactly. And you know what? I think after working in the museum, you know, we have a coworker that said, you know, you're looking with your 2021 glasses on, where society is different and you need to take these off and put on your 1944 glasses or your 1860 glasses, or start looking at things from their perspective in society. And I think what's so great today about, you know, society today and with us doing this podcast is that we can, you know, literally give credit where credit is due. And it's more acceptable. It's more accepted in society now because, you know, yes, there are still like major issues with like sex and race and and religion and everything like that, politics even. But I think everybody looks at it more openly. Maybe. Maybe that's what like the things that I've come across.
No, and I mean, and this is another reason why we have this podcast, is so we can like talk about this and see each other's viewpoints. And I think we both just respect each other so much that we are able to do this. So I appreciate the heck out of you for that.
That might just be like what I've come across in like reenacting. I swear it's village training where I'm like, the presentation is coming out and it's just doing the thing.
it's definitely true. Like, you do have to look at it from those perspectives. However, at the same time, there were badass women even then trying to pave the way.
Yeah.
And try to go against everything that was considered normal for, you know, women roles to be. I mean, honestly, like, and I'm not bringing up like a movie. Well, I guess it is technically a movie, but like, you look at Little Women, you look at Jo March, right? Mm-hmm. And this is during the Civil War. And sure, she has a role that she has to play. You know, Amy's the oldest, and Beth is the oldest. Crap. Sorry. I should know my Little Women, damn it.
Somebody's the oldest. Okay.
But regardless, you have women like Jo March who goes against the grain to pave this. She wants to be a writer. And Louisa May Alcott wrote this during this time period as well. And women had to, essentially, if they really wanted to make it big as a writer, they had to have a male name, right? They had to have a pseudonym, basically.
Yeah.
And but there were always women who were doing that. So I don't necessarily think that we need to look at it from that perspective. I think we need to acknowledge the badass women who came before. Like, yes, acknowledge the badass women who came before us, but acknowledge the ones who really paved the way for us to be able to have these freedoms. Because it definitely, it's been a long struggle, and it just comes across everything. Because I guarantee you, there were female historians too at the time who were probably like, the fuck are you doing? Like, why are you just catering it to you? Like, this is stupid. But we don't know about those female historians because white men like to push their history.
Yeah.
In the words of the chief from Pocahontas, these white men are dangerous. Right.
Oh, snap. She's pulling in Pocahontas. Oh, snap.
Sorry.
I think, like,
Disney version.
So I think, like, why I brought up, you know, like, our coworker being like, oh, you're looking at it through, you know, 2020 lenses versus this time period, is because we had so many people just looking at it from today's perspective. But I also think, like, why we have the podcast is so great, and why those women who are paving the way for more women, is I had an encounter with two young girls at a reenactment. I was Annie, and they ran up to me and just like started yanking on my skirt. And I'm just like, what? Hi, how are you? And they were like, are you in the military? And they got like so excited. And I like explained everything to them. And they were like, oh my goodness, that is so cool. They were so excited. And the dad was just like, thank you so much for showing this, because we've never seen this. I didn't believe it. Like, I was like, what are they doing? But like, the amazing thing is that we're still telling these stories, and they're still paving the way, I feel like, for people even to today like for you, for example, when you heard Joan Clark's story and you wanted to become a cryptologist, you know? So I think that is still really cool because it's still pushing women to do things and go against the grain and
Absolutely.
start, you know, making a way for future women. And I think it's fantastic, you know. So,
I totally agree. I think it's just I know we talked about this with Rachel's episode with the Night Witches, is that women are really coming into their time now. You know, for so long women have been oppressed, especially, and I'm totally gonna touch base on like women of color. Like, you know, they've been so restricted, and now because of how fraught, like how hard people have fought. I mean, we're still in this fight together, not just in general, just all across the board, I will say. And if that offends anybody, sorry, this is our podcast. I'm not gonna lie. But anyway, women, you know, who are, you know, colored women really struggle, and we are now just finding out their contributions to NASA, to being brilliant mathematicians and just ingenious beyond all belief, and we're now just finding out about this. Like, why? That's not okay. And that's why I think you can't look at them like, oh, well, it was the 1950s, it was the 1960s. You know, yeah, okay, social context, civil rights, I understand, you know, segregation. Okay, sure. However, once that this information became known, write about it. Stop pushing people down just to tell your narrative. And I think that's why I get so frustrated, and why I could never ever teach history at any level, because it's just stupid. Like, so one of the people I work with, an administrator for social studies, in the county below us, and he was picking my brain. He's like, oh, well, how would you, you know, teach something? And I was like, get rid of all your textbooks. He's like, what? I was like, get rid of all your textbooks. Like, it's like, why? I said, okay, do your textbooks have contributions to women? He's like, nah, not necessarily. I was like,
Goodbye.
Awesome. And then I was like, what about good representation of like the Tulsa massacre, right? During the 60s. And he was like, maybe not. I was like, get that one out too. I was like, literally, and that's why I have such a problem with like, yeah, so you have to take in the social context. I get that. But deep within those social contexts are an allegiance of badass women and people of color who've come so far, but their stories aren't shared because people continue to just look at the social context and say, oh, that was okay for
That
the
was just the
time.
time period. No, it's like time is evolving, and we need to do, I'm just gonna say it, we need to do better as a race of just humans. We need to do better. And I think that's what's so great about like this conversation, is that it's very open, it's very honest. We can have these conversations. And I mean, we've had conversations before. We didn't necessarily like see eye to eye like on everything, or we've, you know, it's I don't want to say like we were disagreeing. We were just approaching it from different angles. And I think that's great that we can do this in like an open forum. And yeah, I completely agree. Like, if I was a history teacher, I would just straight up run in and like throw all the books out and be like, everybody come with me. We're going to a museum. Because when I was in school, I like loved history class and I hated it at the same time, because I'm like, dear Lord, I don't want to learn about another battle that took place in medieval times. I don't care. And then we got to the Aztecs, or, you know, Aztecs, whatever. Obviously, my timeline is skewed, but I'm just like, I can't do it. There's more to history than just wars, which is so cool. As which I'm gonna get you to come out to a reenactment,
Yes,
Renee
please.
cubed, Renee the third,
Renee the third.
because it's one thing to read history, I feel like you're just adding extra layers on top of it when you do reenacting, because you can try to put yourself in that mindset. And that's something that I do when I portray Renee from Battle of the Bulge. I try to think, like, mm-hmm. what was she experiencing, or what was her thought process when she's seeing these men come in wounded, or when she's running out of medicine, or, you know, she's... Duh, I don't want to go on about it because I'm going to get, like, emotional. No. But, like, it's just... You get that overwhelming feeling of what they might have been feeling.
And I know, and I totally, I absolutely understand where you're coming from with that. And I guess to really bring it back to the two women that we were talking about with Elizabeth Freeman and Joan Clark, is that, you know, you can sit there and say, like, oh, we can go back and look at society and maybe see how they felt because, oh, they were women and these extremely male dominated fields, they couldn't advance further. The credit was always taken. You know, J. Edgar Hoover took all of the credits, rights for Elizabeth Freeman. Necessarily say that the rest of those in Hut 8 took the entire credit. I think they really respected Joan Clark, but obviously we didn't know about Joan Clark for a very long time. And the reason why is because those primary sources are so, they're just in, I'm just going to say chaos, right? Like, we don't know where they're at because it's just a field of chaos of just men's stories being told and taking credit that we can't read those primary sources to say, like, oh, so this is how they felt even within this society. And so, I mean, like, I appreciate, you know, what you're saying with Renee. I just also think, and I wanted to touch base on when we sit there and we think about it, and it goes back to working at Greenfield Village and the mission statement that Ryan Spencer always made us say that is still embedded into my head. So Ryan Spencer, if you are listening, that mission statement I think about quite a bit, but really connecting the past to the present. And that is what you were supposed to do as a presenter, as a reenactor, as a historian, as just somebody who gives honestly a rat's ass about humanity in general. Like, you learn history so you can prevent history, and you also, or at least from prevent it from happening further, but you also learn history and you really dig deep and understand a well-rounded version of it, not the Bill O'Reilly version of history. As I'm straight up mean mugging my laptop. Not the Bill O'Reilly version of history, but a true well-rounded version of history has all parties represented, yeah, regardless of the era. And yes, that is just something I will say and I will stick to my grave with, because
yeah,
during these time periods of World War II specifically, as we mentioned with Rachel, women were really coming into their own during this time period. You know, the Soviet women really paved the way for those combat arms type roles. Joan Clark and Elizabeth Freeman really paved the way for cryptologists at least to be known. I did touch base and say during that Night Witches episode that there were female cryptologists or code breakers in Paris on the American side that were put up. But also, we also don't know how, when you think about the resistance going into World War II as well, you know a lot more about the men. But I know, as I mentioned, Sophie Scholl, there is also Irina Sadler. There's so many impeccably wonderful women in history that we don't learn about. I think until it's, I don't want to say it's too late, but we don't learn about them. And that could be, I'm guessing what I'm basically saying is that if we can pave that way, whether it's on our podcast or reenacting and having two little girls come up to you, or having conversations with young girls, and even not just young girls, but just women in general, and even opening the dialogue to men, if we can pave that path to open up those doors so somebody can look at them and be like, oh my God, they did this and I want to do that, right? I think that's something that really needs to be looked at and why history is so important. I will say my sister, not to like ramble, but like my sister is due any within the next couple of months. She's having a girl.
Yay.
And I was at Target. Yay. I was at Target and I was looking at books because I love books, you know this, and so does my sister.
Yeah.
And I found a book called, it was like, Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls. And it's all of these badass women all throughout the years. It goes from like Marie Curie to Jane Austen to Sally Ride to just all of these amazing women. And I think we need more of that. Mm-hmm. And we need to instill the fact that the sky isn't the limit, right? It's just the next part of the journey and history and women's history. Hell, we just got a freaking national museum for women not that long ago. The fuck? Like, I'm so sorry, listeners, that I'm swearing a lot.
But field trip, though.
But seriously. Like, come on. Let's and even go. Then, like, it's... Even then, like, it's not filled to the caliber of other museums, I don't believe. If you've been... If any listener has been to that museum, please literally write us an email or send us a message, either on Instagram or Facebook, because I want to know your thoughts on it.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I love it. Well, that was a great ramble. And I'm going to give shout out to our, I think it was fantastic. And I'm going to give a shout out to our podcast across the pond, the Reenactors Ramble. And if you haven't listened to it, what are you doing besides listening to our podcast? You should be listening to both podcasts.
They're great. At the same time.
Well, I don't know about at the same time. They're probably. But they're great. And they're just wonderful, wonderful guys. Very jealous that they got to interview cast members of Band of Brothers. Maybe one day we'll get there. Who knows?
Maybe.
But.
That would be fun.
In the meantime, speaking of Band of Brothers, next week's episode is all about Renee. And I'm very excited to talk about Renee because it's going to just, so good. So
can
good.
Can we talk about Doc Rowe?
And Doc Rowe.
Plasma. Who was not really a doc. Plasma. He was just a medic.
Plasma. I love the way he says that. Plasma. To heal people with the hands. Plasma. I think it's fantastic. I actually met his grandson twice at D-Day Conneaut. So... Yes. Very just Doc Rowe is my favorite character on Band of Brothers. Just
no.
Hands down.
How could you?
He's okay. So cute.
Hello.
He's so cute. When he's like Hello. Waiting for the guys to come back for like let me rephrase. He's probably like my go-to favorite, but all of them are my favorites and like it's hard to pick one.
No. No. I am so, we're fighting. We are straight up.
Well,
fighting.
We can do this off camera because we are about to end this episode. Girl, it's 29:23 seconds. We are ending this episode.
Damian Lewis, who plays Major Dick Winters. How could you?
Okay, yes. They're all good in their own rights. Okay, I stand by my decision. Well, thank you, everybody, and can't wait to hear more about us rambling on about our favorite Band of Brothers characters and also Renee next week. So stay tuned, and you guys have a good week, and we will talk to you soon.
Gotta dance. Yeah.